We all experience long winters. And up at Holden, during long winters, I found it's a very pleasurable experience to read books in which people can go places and enjoy themselves, whether or not it's in the sun or not. Winter is a time of almost, up here, of almost unbearable closeness. The sun only comes through the mountains, between the mountains here in the saddle for about 20 minutes a day. So you don't see much sun, and then it snows. It snows 3 days out of four, so you don't often see blue sky. And it has been, for me, a time for reading novels. And one of the novels, kinds of novels that are fun to read are called picaresque novels. And originally, they were novels of vagabonds who sort of journeyed around and were usually rather immoral or amoral creatures who managed to make a lot of money or at least adventure out of the so-called moral society. The three novels I'm going to read from tonight are not, I suppose, exactly picaresque novels, but they're in the broader range of them. And one of them that I've enjoyed very much through the years that I'll start out with is Cervantes' Don Quixote. And those of you who know the story of Don Quixote, at least the general outline, know that it's about Don Quixote de la Mancha, who styles himself as Don Quixote de la Mancha. And he goes out with his faithful servant, Sancho Panza, who becomes his squire. And the two of them go out on all sorts of misadventures. Don Quixote has gone rather mad and believes that everything he runs into is a large castle, when it's actually an inn, and a windmill, of course, or giants, etc., etc. He gets into all sorts of misadventures, and each one of the adventures is a story in itself, and so it can be read almost before bedtime on long, on those long evenings, and one gets out of oneself, out of one's geographical place, anyway, which at times happens to be Holden for me. Now, the two other novels I'll read from, one of them is Pickwick Papers, which is very episodic. Charles Dickens wrote that in the last century, and he, of course, wrote it for newspapers once a month, and he had a different episode every month. And the last one I read from is from this century. It's called The Good Companions by J.B. Priestley, and it's a story of a bunch of touring, or one touring theatrical company, and the actors and the amateurs who have their adventures and misadventures. From Don Quixote, I'll start out with, and we'll just kind of go from there, and we'll see about how much we'll read, depending on the time. We should be through all of them in a half an hour. But sit back, think of yourself as being in the cold and the dark, and enjoy a trip. And in this adventure, our ingenious knight, what happens to him when he takes an inn for a castle, as he often does. Don Quixote has just managed to get himself beaten up by various people that he's taken for enemies of his conquering army. Anyway, the innkeeper, who saw Don Quixote lying across the ass, asked Sancho what was wrong with him. Sancho replied that it was nothing, that he had fallen off a rock and bruised his ribs slightly. Now, the innkeeper's wife was a woman of a different sort from the generality of hostesses, for she was kindly by nature and felt for her neighbor's misfortunes. So she immediately set about the cure of Don Quixote and made her young daughter, a very good-looking girl, help her to tend him. There was an Asturian maid at the inn, broad-faced, flat-nosed, and with a head that seemed to have no back to it. She was blind of one eye, not too sound in the other, but she made up for her other shortcomings by her bodily allurements. She was not more than 3 feet high from head to toe, and her shoulders, which were rather on the heavy side, made her look down on the ground more than she liked. This charming maid, then, helped her young mistress, and the two of them made a very poor bed for Don Quixote in an attic, which had evidently served once for a long time as a straw loft. There was a carrier lodging in this garret as well. His bed stood a little farther from the door than our knight's, and although it consisted only of his mule saddles and blankets, it was a good deal better than Don Quixote's, which was made up of four badly planed boards, resting on a pair of not-too-even trestles. A mattress, thin as a quilt and full of lumps, which were as hard as stones to the touch, but appeared through various rents in the cover to be wool, two sheets made of the leather used for shields, and a coverlet whose every thread anyone who wished could have counted without missing a single one.
On this execrable bed, Don Quixote lay down, whereupon the hostess and her daughter poulticed him from head to foot, while Maritornes, for this was the Asturian maid's name, held a light. The hostess, as she plastered him, seeing that parts of his body were covered with weals, remarked that he must have had a beating, not a fall. "It wasn't a beating," said Sancho, "but the rock had a lot of jags and knobs, and each one must have made its mark. And by the way, if you could be so very kind as to leave a little of that wadding, it might come in handy for someone, for my back's giving me a bit of trouble, too." "Oh, I see," replied the hostess. "You must have had a fall as well." "I didn't fall," said Sancho, "but I got such a shock from seeing my master tumble that my body aches all over as if I had been beaten black and blue." "That may well be," said the innkeeper's daughter, "for very often I've dreamt I fell off a tower and never reached the ground, and when I've woken up, I found myself as bruised and bumped as if I had really tumbled." "But here's the point, lady," replied Sancho Panza. "I wasn't dreaming. I was more wide awake than I am now, and there I was, almost as bruised as my master, Don Quixote." "What's the gentleman's name?" asked the Asturian maid. "Don Quixote de la Mancha," replied Sancho Panza. "He's a knight-errant, one of the best and bravest the world has seen for a very long time." "What's a knight-errant?" asked the maid. "Are you so green that you don't know that?" replied Sancho. "Then I'll tell you, my girl, that a knight-errant, to cut the long story short, is beaten up one day and made emperor the next. Today he's the most unfortunate and poverty-stricken creature in the world. Tomorrow he'll have two or three kingdoms to give to his squire." "Well, seeing that you have such a fine master," said the hostess, "how is it that you aren't at least a count?" "There's plenty of time yet," replied Sancho. "We've only been out seeking adventures for a month, and up to now we haven't come across anything worth calling one. And sometimes, when you're looking for one thing, you find another. But I promise you that if my master, Don Quixote, recovers from his wound or fall, and if I'm not crippled by mine, I won't swap my chances for all the noblest titles in Spain." Here Don Quixote, who had listened very attentively to all this chatter, sat up in bed as best he could, and taking the hostess's hand, addressed her. "Believe me, beauteous lady, you may count yourself fortunate to have lodging in your castle a person whom I must refrain from praising, only because self-praise is said to be a practice unworthy of a gentleman. But my squire will tell you who I am. I will only say that I bear the services you have done me eternally inscribed on my memory, so that I may remain grateful to you all the days of my life. Had it not pleased heaven to keep me in such abject servitude to love's laws and to the eyes of that ungrateful beauty whose name I dare hardly breathe, then the eyes of your beauteous daughter would hold my freedom captive." The hostess, her daughter, and the worthy Maritornes were bewildered by the knight-errant's words, which might have been Greek, so little could they understand them, though they realized that they were all intended as thanks and compliments. But as they were not used to such language, they stared at him in amazement, for he seemed so very different from the sort of men they were accustomed to. So, thanking him in their innkeeper's language, they left him, and the Asturian maid tended Sancho, who was in no less need of attention than his master. Now the carrier had arranged with her that they should spend the night together in healthy sport, and she had promised that once the guests were very quiet and her master mistress asleep, she would come to him and give him all the pleasure he could desire. And it is told to the credit of this good girl that she never made such promises without fulfilling them, even if she made them from far away in the mountains and without any witness at all, for she prided herself on being a maiden of breeding and did not feel degraded by serving in an inn, because only misfortune and ill chance, as she said, had brought her to that pass. Don Quixote's hard, narrow, miserable apology for a bed was the first in the starlit barn, and next to beside him, Sancho made his, which consisted only of a rush mat and a horse blanket, which seemed to be of threadbare canvas rather than of wool. Beyond these two came the carrier's bed, made, as we have said, of saddles and all the trappings of the two best mules he had. He had 12 glossy, well-covered, splendid beasts, for he was one of the richest muleteers in Arevalo, as the author of this history tells us. And he makes a special mention of this carrier because he knew him very well, and it is suggested that he was some relation of his. But, however that may be, Cid Hamet Benengeli was a very exact historian and very precise in all his details, as can be seen by his not passing over these various points, trivial and petty though they may be. He should be an example to those grave historians who give us so short and skimped an account of events that we scarcely taste them, and so the most substantial part of their work, out of carelessness, malice, or ignorance, remains in their inkhorns. 1,000 blessings, then, on the author of the Tablanta di Ricamonte, and the writer of that other book, which tells us of the deeds of Count Tomillas, for the exhaustiveness for which they describe everything. But to return to the story. After the carrier visited his mules and given them their second feed, he stretched himself on his pack saddles and awaited his most punctual Maritornes. By now, Sancho was poulticed and lay down, but though he tried to sleep, the pain in his sides would not allow him. Don Quixote, too, with the pain of his ribs, was no more able to close his eyes than a hare. The whole inn was in silence, and there was no other light in it, but that of a hanging lamp which burnt in the center of the doorway. This phenomenal quiet and his habitual preoccupation with the adventures that are related on every page of those books that had been his undoing wrought one of the strangest possible fancies in our knight's imagination. He thought that he had arrived at a famous castle, for, as we have said, every inn where he stayed seemed to him a castle, and that the innkeeper's daughter was really the daughter of the warden. Overwhelmed by his nobility, she had fallen in love with him, and, what is more, she had promised that very night when her parents were asleep to come and lie with him a while. And taking all this fantasy, which he had invented for the sober truth, he began to be disturbed and to think of the critical danger to which his honor was exposed, deciding in his heart to commit no treason against the Lady Dulcinea del Toboso, even though Queen Guinevere and her Lady Quinitiona should appear before him. Whilst he was brooding on this nonsense, unfortunately for him, the time arrived for the Asturian maid's visit. She came in her shift with bare feet and hair done in a fustian kerchief. With soft and noiseless steps, she entered the garret into which the three men were lodged in search of a carrier. But scarcely had she reached the door when Don Quixote heard her, and sitting up in bed, despite his plasters and his aching ribs, he stretched out his arms to receive his beauteous maiden. She was gliding modestly and silently, groping with outstretched hands for her lover, when she stumbled into the arms of Don Quixote, who seized her tightly by one wrist, and drawing her to him, she, not daring to say a word, forced her to sit on his bed. Then he felt her shift, and although it was of sackcloth, it seemed to him of the finest, most delicate satin. The glass beads that she wore on her wrist had for him the sheen of rare orient pearls. Her hair, which was as coarse as a horse's mane, seemed to him strands of the most glistening gold of Arabia, whose splendor eclipsed the very sun. And her mouth, which no doubt reeked of the stale salad of the night before, seemed to him to breathe out a sweet and aromatic odor. In short, he bestowed on her each several feature of that famous princess who came in the books he had read to visit the sore wounded knight whom she loved so well. In every detail of dress and bearing, his imagination copied her exactly, and so blind was the poor knight that neither her touch nor her breath nor anything else about the good maiden revealed his mistake to him, though she would have turned the stomach of anyone but a carrier. Far from it, he imagined that he held in his arms the goddess of beauty, and gripping her tight in soft, amorous tones, he began. Would that I could find means, most lovely and high-born lady, with which I could repay the singular favor you have done me in displaying your great beauty. But fortune, which is never weary of persecuting good men, has laid me on this bed, so bruised and battered that even if I wished to satisfy your desires, I could not. And besides that impediment, there is another and greater, the pledge of faith that I have given to the peerless Dulcinea del Toboso, sole mistress of my most secret thoughts. But were I not prevented in this way, I should not be so simple a knight as to pass the happy chance you have deigned to offer me. Maritornes was bathed in a sweat of anguish at finding herself grasped by Don Quixote, and without understanding or paying the least attention to his protestations, tried silently to break loose. As for the good carrier, whose lusts kept him awake, he had heard his wench from the moment she came in, and had been listening attentively to the knight's every word. Suspecting that the Asturian maid had broken her promise to him in favor of another, he edged nearer and nearer to Don Quixote's bed, silently waiting to see what his incomprehensible speech might lead to. But when he saw the maid struggling to break loose and Don Quixote trying to hold her, the jest seemed to him to have gone too far. Whereupon he raised his arm and dealt the amorous knight a terrible blow on his lean jaws so that his mouth was filled with blood, and not content with this, he trod on his ribs and trampled him up and down at a lively rate. The bed was rather weak and supported on no firm foundation, so unable to bear the additional weight of the carrier, it gave in with a great crash. This woke the innkeeper, who called for Maritornes, and getting no reply, suspected that she must be the cause of the noise. With this in his mind, he got up, lighting a lamp, made his way towards the scene of the disturbance. The maid, hearing her master coming in, and knowing his very bad temper, in fear and alarm, climbed into the bed of the still-sleeping Sancho, and huddled up in a ball. At this point, the innkeeper entered, shouting, "Where are you? This is your doing, Maritornes, I'm sure of it." Whereat Sancho, feeling this weight almost on top of him, thought it was a nightmare, and began to strike out right and left. A good number of his blows fell on Maritornes, who, with the pain of them, forgot her modesty and gave him as many in return. This dispelled his dream, and finding himself thus treated and not knowing by whom, he clinched with Maritornes, and the two of them started the most stubborn and comical scuffle in the world, whereupon the carrier, seeing by the light of the innkeeper's lamp how ill his mistress was faring, left Don Quixote and joined in to give her all the necessary help. So did the innkeeper, but with a different purpose, to beat the maid, under the impression that she was the sole cause of all that harmony. And then, as the saying goes, the cat chased the rat chased the rope chased the stick. The carrier beat Sancho, Sancho beat the maid beat him, the innkeeper beat the maid, and they all laid it on so fast that they never took a moment's rest. While, to improve the joke, the innkeeper's lamp went out and left them all in a heap in the dark, lambing out unmercifully and dealing great execution wherever they hit. It happened that there was staying in the inn that night an officer of the ancient and holy brotherhood of Toledo, who also heard the extraordinary din of the fight, and seizing his wand of office and the tin box with his warrants in it, went up into the room in the dark, crying, "Stop in the name of justice! Stop in the name of the holy brotherhood!" Now the first person he collided with was the poor trampled knight, lying on his back, unconscious amidst the ruins of his bed, and his hand touching the knight's beard as he groped. The officer repeated, "Help the officers of the law!" But seeing the man he had seized neither struggled nor stirred, he took him for dead, and the people in the garret for his murderers, which made him shout even louder, "Shut the inn door, let no one go out. There's been a man murdered here." The cry alarmed them all, and as soon as they heard it, they stopped the brawl. The innkeeper slipped back to his room, the carrier to his pack saddles, the maid to her quarter. Only the unfortunate Don and Sancho were unable to stir from where they lay. At this, the officer let go Don Quixote's beard and went out to find a light with the intention of seeking and arresting the criminals. But he could not find one because the innkeeper had purposely put out the lamp when he retired to his quarters. So the officer had to go across to the hearth, where, after much time and trouble, he lit another. Well, that goes on and on.
The 16th century was famous for its inns, I'm sure. But there's a little violence at Holden that we have to read more, you know, find out what goes on in the outside world since we don't have television. Those of you, probably the most famous picaresque novel we know in English is Tom Jones. I don't know. Most of us have seen the movie and missed the book. But that's where one character of very, well, not of ill repute, but he certainly has his problems, finally does in the end manage to marry the girl he loves. Mr. Pickwick, which is some centuries later, some three centuries later than Don Quixote, is much gentler in tone, and the story follows the adventures of Mr. Pickwick and the members of his club, who are the traveling members. Pickwick himself is rather a Don Quixote figure. He's a little more of a does not have quite so riotous adventures, but does manage to do quite a few of the same things. He never mistakes an inn for a castle, his three friends, his four friends who go with him, Mr. Tupman, Mr. Winkle, Mr. Snodgrass, and his servant Sam Weller, manage to get themselves into quite a bit of trouble, which keeps the series running for a long time. And this is the book that got Dickens, really, his early fame after Sketches by Boz. Well, anyway, this is Mr. Pickwick on the Ice. I couldn't find a copy of Pickwick, so I borrowed this from the English department here. This is during Christmas, and they're visiting their friend, the old squire, Mr. Wardle. Old Wardle led the way to a pretty large sheet of ice, and the fat boy and Mr. Weller, having shoveled and swept away the snow which had fallen on it during the night, Mr. Bob Sawyer adjusted his skates with a dexterity which, to Mr. Winkle, was perfectly marvelous, and described circles with his left leg and cut figures of eight and inscribed upon the ice without once stopping for breath a great many other pleasant and astonishing devices, to the excessive satisfaction of Mr. Pickwick, Mr. Tupman, and the ladies, within which reached a pitch of positive enthusiasm when old Wardle and Benjamin Allen, assisted by the aforesaid Bob Sawyer, performed some mystic evolutions, which they called a reel. All this time, Mr. Winkle, with his face and hands blue with cold, had been forcing a gimlet into the soles of his feet, and putting his skates on with the points behind, and getting the straps into a very complicated and entangled snare with the assistance of Mr. Snodgrass, who knew rather less about skates than a Hindu. At length, however, with the assistance of Mr. Weller, the unfortunate skates were firmly screwed and buckled on, and Mr. Winkle was raised to his feet. "Now then, sir," said Sam in an encouraging tone, "off with you, and show him how to do it." "Stop, Sam, stop," said Mr. Winkle, trembling violently and clutching hold of Sam's arm with the grasp of a drowning man. "How slippery it is, Sam." "Not an uncommon thing upon ice, sir," replied Mr. Weller. "Hold up, sir." This last observation of Mr. Weller's bore reference to a demonstration Mr. Winkle had made at that instant of a frantic desire to throw his feet in the air and dash back of his head on the ice. These are very awkward, ain't they, Sam?" inquired Mr. Winkle, staggering. "I'm afraid there's an awkward gentleman in them, sir," replied Sam.
"Now, Winkle," cried Mr. Pickwick, quite unconscious that there was anything the matter. "Come, the ladies are all anxiety." "Yes, yes," replied Mr. Winkle with a ghastly smile. "I'm coming." "Just a-going to begin," said Sam, endeavoring to disengage himself. "Now, sir, start off."
"Stop an instant, Sam," gasped Mr. Winkle, clinging most affectionately to Mr. Weller.
"I find I've got a couple of coats at home that I don't want, Sam."
"You may have them, Sam."
"Thank you, sir," replied Mr. Weller.
"Never mind touching your hat, Sam," said Mr. Winkle hastily. "You needn't take your hand away to do that. I meant to have given you 5 shillings in the morning for a Christmas box, Sam. I'll give it to you this afternoon, Sam."
"You're very good, sir," replied Mr. Weller.
"Just hold me at first, Sam, will you?" said Mr. Winkle.
"There, that's right. Now I shall soon get in the way of it, Sam. Not too fast, Sam, not too fast." Mr. Winkle, stooping forward with his body half doubled up, was being assisted over the ice by Mr. Weller in a very singular and unswan-like manner, when Mr. Pickwick most innocently shouted from the opposite bank.
"Sam!"
"Sir," said Mr. Weller.
"Here, I want you."
"Let go, sir," said Sam.
"Don't you hear the governor calling?"
"Let go, sir." With a violent effort, Mr. Weller disengaged himself from the grasp of the agonized Pickwickian, and in so doing administered a considerable impetus to the unhappy Mr. Winkle. With an accuracy which no degree of dexterity or practice could have ensured, that unfortunate gentleman bore swiftly down into the center of the reel at the very moment when Mr. Bob Sawyer was performing a flourish of unparalleled beauty. Mr. Winkle struck wildly against him, and with a loud crash they both fell heavily down. Mr. Pickwick ran to the spot. Bob Sawyer had risen to his feet, but Mr. Winkle was far too wise to do anything of the kind in skates. He was seated on the ice, making spasmodic efforts to smile, but anguish was depicted on every lineament of his countenance.
"Are you hurt?" inquired Mr. Benjamin Allen with great anxiety.
"Not much," said Mr. Winkle, rubbing his back very hard.
"I wish you'd let me bleed you," said Mr. Benjamin with great eagerness.
"No, thank you," replied Mr. Winkle hurriedly.
"I really think you had better," said Allen.
"Thank you," replied Mr. Winkle. "I'd rather not."
"What do you think, Mr. Pickwick?" inquired Bob Sawyer. Mr. Pickwick was excited and indignant. He beckoned to Mr. Weller and said in a stern voice, "Take his skates off."
"No, but really, I've scarcely begun," remonstrated Mr. Winkle.
"Take his skates off," repeated Mr. Pickwick firmly. The command was not to be resisted. Mr. Winkle allowed Sam to obey it in silence.
"Lift him up," said Mr. Pickwick. Sam assisted him to rise. Mr. Pickwick retired a few spaces apart from the bystanders, and beckoning his friend to approach, fixed a searching look upon him and uttered in a low but distinct and emphatic tone these remarkable words.
"You're a humbug, sir."
"A what?" said Mr. Winkle, staring.
"A humbug, sir. I will speak plainer, if you wish it.
An impostor, sir."
With these words, Mr. Pickwick turned slowly on his heel and rejoined his friends. While Mr. Pickwick was delivering himself of the sentiment just recorded, Mr. Weller and the fat boy, having by their joint endeavors cut out a slide, were exercising themselves thereupon in a very masterly and brilliant manner. Sam Weller, in particular, was displaying that beautiful feat of fancy sliding which is currently denominated knocking at the cobbler's door, and which is achieved by skimming over on the ice on one foot and occasionally giving a twopenny postman's knock upon it with the other. It was a good long slide, and there was something in the motion which Mr. Pickwick, who was very cold with standing still, could not help envying.
"It looks a nice warm exercise, that, doesn't it?"
he inquired of Wardle, when that gentleman was thoroughly out of breath by reason of the indefatigable manner in which he had converted his legs into a pair of compasses and drawn complicated problems on the ice.
"Ah, it does indeed," replied Wardle. "Do you slide?"
"I used to do so on the gutters when I was a boy," replied Mr. Pickwick.
"Try it now," said Wardle.
"Oh, do please, Mr. Pickwick," cried all the ladies.
"I should be very happy to afford you any amusement," replied Mr. Pickwick,
"but I haven't done such a thing in 30 years.
"Pooh, pooh, nonsense," said Wardle, dragging off his skates with the impetuosity which characterized all his proceedings. "Here, I'll keep you company. Come along."
And away went the good-tempered old fellow down the slide with a rapidity with which came very close upon Mr. Weller and beat the fat boy all to nothing. Mr. Pickwick paused, considered, pulled off his gloves and put them in his hat, took 2 or 3 short turns, balked himself as often, and at last took another run and went slowly and gravely down the slide with his feet about 1.25 yards apart, amidst the gratified shouts of all the spectators.
"Keep the Potter Island, sir," said Sam,
and down went Wardle again, and then Mr. Pickwick, and then Sam, and then Mr. Winkle, and then Mr. Bob Sawyer, and then the fat boy, and then Mr. Snodgrass, following closely upon each other's heels and running after each other with as much eagerness as if all their future prospects in life depended on their expedition. It was the most intensely interesting thing to observe the manner in which Mr. Pickwick performed his share in the ceremony, to watch the torture of anxiety with which he viewed the person behind gaining upon him at the imminent hazard of tripping him up, to see him gradually expend the painful force which he had put on at first,
and turned slowly round on the slide with his face toward the point from which he had started, to contemplate the playful smile which mantled on his face when he had accomplished the distance, and the eagerness with which he turned round when he had done so and ran after his predecessor, his black gaiters tripping pleasantly through the snow and his eyes beaming cheerfulness and gladness through his spectacles. And when he was knocked down, which happened upon the average every third round, it was the most invigorating sight that can possibly be imagined to behold him gathering up his hat, gloves, and handkerchief with a glowing countenance, and resume his station in the rank with an ardor and enthusiasm that nothing could abate. The sport was at its height, the sliding was at its quickest, the laughter was at its loudest, when a sharp, smart crack was heard. There was a quick rush toward the bank, a wild scream from the ladies, a shout from Mr. Tupman. A large mass of ice had disappeared. The water bubbled up over it. Mr. Pickwick's hat, gloves, and handkerchief were floating on the surface, and this was all of Mr. Pickwick that anybody could see. Dismay and anguish were depicted on every countenance. The males turned pale, and females fainted. Mr. Snodgrass and Mr. Winkle grasped each other by the hand and gazed at the spot where their leader had gone down with frenzied eagerness, while Mr. Tupman, by way of rendering the promptest assistance, and at the same time conveying to any persons who might be within hearing the clearest possible notion of the catastrophe, ran off across the country at his utmost speed, screaming, "Fire!" with all his might. It was at this very moment, when old Wardle and Sam Weller were approaching the hole with cautious steps, and Mr. Benjamin Allen was holding a hurried consultation with Mr. Bob Sawyer on the advisability of bleeding the company generally, as an improving little bit of professional practice, it was at this very moment that a face, head, and shoulders emerged from beneath the water and disclosed the features and spectacles of Mr. Pickwick. "Keep yourself up for an instant, for only one instant," bawled Mr. Snodgrass. "Yes, do let me implore you for my sake," roared Mr. Winkle, deeply affected. The adjuration was rather unnecessary, the probability being that if Mr. Pickwick had declined to keep himself up for anybody else's sake, it would have occurred to him that he might as well do so for his own. "Do you feel the bottom there, old fellow?" said Wardle. "Yes, certainly," replied Mr. Pickwick, wringing the water from his head and face and gasping for breath. "I fell upon my back. I couldn't get up on my feet at first." The clay upon so much of Mr. Pickwick's coat as was yet visible bore testimony to the accuracy of this statement. And as the fears of the spectators were still further relieved by the fat boy suddenly recollecting that the water was nowhere more than 5 feet deep, prodigies of valor were performed to get him out. After a vast quantity of splashing and cracking and struggling, Mr. Pickwick was at length fairly extracted from his unpleasant position and once more stood on dry land. "Oh, he'll catch his death of cold," said Emily. "Dear old thing," said Arabella, "let me wrap this shawl around you, Mr. Pickwick." "Ah, that's the best thing you can do," said Wardle. "And when you've got it on, run home as fast as your legs can carry you and jump into bed directly." A dozen shawls were offered on the instant. Three or four of the thickest having been selected, Mr. Pickwick was wrapped up and started off under the guidance of Mr. Weller, presenting the singular phenomenon of an elderly gentleman dripping wet and without a hat, with his arms bound down his side, skimming over the ground without any clearly defined purpose at the rate of 6 good English miles an hour. But Mr. Pickwick cared not for appearances in such an extreme case, and urged on by Mr. Weller, he kept at the very top of his speed until he reached the door of Manor Farm, where Mr. Tupman had arrived some 5 minutes before and had frightened the old lady into palpitations of the heart by impressing her with the unalterable conviction that the kitchen chimney was on fire, a calamity which always presented itself in glowing colors to the old lady's mind when anybody about her evinced the smallest agitation. Mr. Pickwick paused not an instant until he was snug in bed. Sam Weller lighted a blazing fire in the room and took up his dinner. A bowl of punch was carried up afterward, and a grand carouse held in honor of his safety. Old Wardle would not hear of his rising, so they made the bed a chair. And Mr. Pickwick presided. A second and a third bowl were ordered in, and when Mr. Pickwick awoke next morning, there was not a symptom of rheumatism about him, which proves, as Mr. Bob Sawyer very justly observed, that there's nothing like hot punch in such cases. And that, if ever a hot punch did fail to act as a preventative, it was merely because the patient fell into the vulgar error of not taking enough of it. Well, this last is Priestley's good companions. J.B. Priestley's still alive. He's about 87 now, I think. He wrote this in 1929, and it's about three people who come from various parts of England and meet in a town in the English Midlands, along with about 10 bankrupt actors, and they decide to start a touring pantomime show. Which is just a series, sort of a musical variety vaudeville show. And this is the story of their adventures from beginning to end. Priestley shares with Cervantes and Dickens the art of overstatement, and
everything else. He does manage so well to evoke scenes. I'd like to read this one paragraph here before I read the little story of their visit, their first sight of the town in the industrial north that's in the depressed area.
Cathedral cities, market towns, ports forgotten by the sea, spas long out of fashion, all these can decay beautifully, and often their charm increases as the life ebbs out of them. Industrial towns, like steam engines, are only even tolerable if they are in working order and puffing away. Tuborough was like an engine with a burst boiler lying on the side of the road. It was a money-making machine that had almost stopped working, for only a wheel here and there shakily revolved, or a pulley gave a groan or two. It was a factory that could now show you nothing but broken windows and litter and moldering ledgers and a mumbling caretaker. It was nothing but an old cash box containing only dust and cobwebs and a few forgotten pence. Trade in Tuborough had nearly disappeared altogether, and it was quite obvious that it would never come back again, would always prefer other and pleasanter places. It was a town of dwindling incomes, terrifying overdrafts, of shopkeepers who lived by stretching one another's credit, of working men who were rapidly becoming nothing but waiting men, their chief occupation being to hang about the doors of buildings that were known, with a fine irony, as labor exchanges. Tuborough had always been one of the ugliest towns in the Midlands, and now it was easily the most depressed and depressing. Its wealth had long ceased to accumulate, but its men still decayed. The days when Tuborough's coal and lace curtains were and tin tacks were in brisk demand everywhere, when many a local man who still liked his tea in a pint pot could buy up the county's Lord Lieutenant, and was known to have shaken Gladstone himself by the hand, these days had gone and had left nothing behind them but a few public buildings in a bad Gothic style, two bewhiskered and blackened statues, some slag heaps, disused factories and sidings, a rotting canal, a large slum area, a generous supply of dirt, rickets, bow legs, and bad teeth. A few years ago, Carol and I were in England, and a lot of those towns still look that way. There's still people living in them, and the trade still hasn't come back. And well, any rate, but he paints it so well that he calls up to my mind all the memories of depression that I can think of. The part I'm going to read is from an earlier section when Inigo Jolifant, who's a teacher who's just been fired from his job and is been trying to make his living as a piano player, gets a ride from the traveling corresponding secretary of the Second Resurrectionist, which is one of those fringe groups, I suppose, of Christians that rose up, especially in England, in the beginning of the Depression, when everything seemed to be over. And these people believed very firmly that the world was going to end in 3 months. And from the way it sounds, I'm sure this is not made up. It sounds like Priestley, who did like to travel around England, ran into these people. At any rate, they're going to have a convention. The secretary is very kindly taking them on, and they're going to have a tea and a convention. It's their third or the last. They're going to have one the next month and the month after that, and that's going to be it. Anyway, Mr. Timpany, the man who's picked him up as an insurance salesman, and he found he couldn't both sell insurance and be a second resurrectionist, which is very wise. It may have been a splendid gathering, but it was certainly a very odd meal. Inigo remembered other high teas, but none higher than this. The forms are benches, everybody sitting on benches, those of you who don't remember what forms are, were a solid mass of eaters and drinkers, and the tables were a solid mass of food. There were hams and tongues and rounds of cold beef and raised pies and egg salads, plates heaped high with white bread, brown bread, currant tea cakes, scones, dishes of jelly and custard and blancmange and fruit salad, piles of jam tarts and maids of honor and cream puffs and almond tarts, then walnut cake, plum cake, chocolate cake, coconut cake, mounds of sugar, quarts of cream, and a steady flood of tea.
Inigo never remembered seeing so much food before. It was like being asked to eat one's way through the provision and cooked food departments of one of the big stores. The appetite was not tickled, not even met fairly. It was overwhelmed. The sight of these tables drove hunger out of the world, made it impossible to imagine it had ever been there. Inigo ate this and that, but he hardly knew what he was eating. He was so warm, so tightly wedged in, so amazed at the spectacle. The second resurrectionists were worthy of the colossal meal spread before them. This highest of high teas had met its match. If they had all been 40 years in the wilderness, they could not have dealt with it more manfully. They were not your gabbling, laughing eaters. They did not make a first rush and then suddenly lose heart. They did not try this and taste that. No, they were quiet, systematic, devastating. They advanced steadily in good order, from the first slice of ham to the last slice of chocolate cake, and in 50 minutes the tables were a mere ruin of broken meats, the flood of tea a pale and tepid trickle. Inigo, who retired early from the conflict, though he had to stay where he was, with Mr. Timpany steaming on one side and Frida delicately grilling on the other, looked on with wonder and admiration. Across the table were two middle-aged women with long yellow faces almost exactly alike, and a little round man who had no teeth and whose nose and chin came within an inch of one another as he worked away. It did not look as if three such persons would be able to do more than skirt the fringes of a high tea, but actually they walked right through and emerged unruffled at the other end. Above their heads, high on the opposite wall, was yet another of Mr. Grudy's crimson placards, which began, "And the light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee." Inigo stared, now at the people, now at the placard. It was all very odd. Tea was over, Frida disappeared, Mr. Timpany was borne away by the daughters of Ephraim and Gad. I should mention that the second resurrectionists have divided England all up into the 12 tribes of Israel. And so everyone is Gad, Dan, Asher, etc. And they believe themselves to be the lost tribes of Israel, and they're being gathered at the very end. Anyway, Inigo strolled outside to taste the air, which had a novel and delicious flavor. After that, he smoked a pipe and sauntered up and down the road, keeping an eye on the door so that he should not miss the fair Frida. A few belated resurrectionists, whose work had kept them from the last Grudy High Tea, but two, that this world would know, hurried into the hall. Then a large car arrived and carefully deposited on the road several persons who evidently could not be expected to grapple with a high tea. There was a tremendous middle-aged woman, purple and commanding, who was attended, as such women so often are attended, by a thin, depressed-looking girl in a frock she had never liked. There was also a tall man with an excessively long and lean brown face and a military bearing. Inigo watched these three new arrivals sail, drift, and march into the hall. Then he caught a glimpse of Frida's blue frock in the doorway. "Well," he asked her, "when does the meeting begin?" "In a minute," she replied. "The Knobs have arrived. Did you see them? They won't come to tea. They're too grand. That woman with the red face and the big nose is Mrs. Bevison Burr, and that's her daughter with her. She never says a single word and wears the most awful clothes. And the man with them is Major Dunker. He's rather nice, but he's a bit cracked." "Never mind. We're all a bit cracked." "You may be," retorted Frida, "but I'm not." "I know what you're going to say next," he told her.
"You don't."
"I do. You were going to say, 'So there.'" "No, I wasn't," cried Frida. Then she made a little face at him, plainly asking for more. This was Frida's idea of conversation. After sitting in corners so long and listening to old people who said things that were either silly or downright frightening, to contradict a young man who smiled at her and had nice eyes, it was lovely. So Inigo exchanged a little more of this stuff, sandbag badinage, she called it, and had time to reflect that if she had worn steel spectacles or scaled 3 stone more, he could not have done it, would have been elsewhere. As it was, he was too happy, delighted with Frida herself, and with the phrase he had just made, and with his own ironical reflections. It was time, however, for the meeting, the gathering, the convention, whatever it was, to begin. The tea things had been cleared away, the tables moved back, and all the forms ranged in front of the little platform. Now Mr. Grudy, Mr. Bevison Burr, Major Dunker, and Mr. Timpany marched onto the platform and looked as if they were about to sing a quartet. Everybody else made a rush at the forms. Frida and Inigo were among the last, with the result that they had to squeeze in at the end of one of the back forms. Frida was jammed against a very stout woman who smiled at her and patted her hand. Inigo was jammed against Frida and had to sit there. In order to sit there at all, he had to hold on to the form itself, just at the back of Frida. There was really only room for half of him on the form. Mr. Grudy stepped to the front of the platform and surveyed them with a benevolent, patriarchal stare, as if he saw before him his shepherds and bowmen and handmaidens and flocks and herds. Then he lifted a hand. Immediately, everybody leaned forward and covered their faces. Inigo was not sure what was about to happen, but he leaned forward, too, with a sharp jerk, so that the arm behind Frida slipped up and landed somewhere in the neighborhood of her waist. She shook herself and whispered something. "Sorry, couldn't help it," he began whispering, and at the same time, by a gigantic effort, contrived to remove the innocently offending arm. She gave him a fierce little shh. Mr. Grudy was opening with prayer. It was rather a long prayer, and Inigo was so uncomfortable, his body being twisted at a fiendish angle, that he found it impossible to listen to it. Nevertheless, he was in sympathy with it, for Mr. Grudy continually referred to captivities and migrations across great deserts, and Inigo felt them in every limb. When everybody sat up again at the end of the prayer, Mr. Grudy stood there very erect and did nothing but look at them for at least 2 minutes. Inigo wondered what was going to happen next. "Gee!" sang Mr. Grudy. Everybody jumped up at once, except Inigo. He sat there a second too long. His end of the form went down, and he fell with a crash. The other end, shooting up and slightly forward, hurled a little round man, with the toothless one, into the seat in front, and there was a confusion and uproar. The hymn could not begin until a little man had been restored to his own row. The seat had been put back in its place, and Inigo, crimson, dusty, and furious, had scrambled to his feet. "Gee!" sang Mr. Grudy again, and this time they were off. Inigo did not sing, for the hymn was one he had not heard before. He felt foolish. When they came to sit down again, he felt still more foolish because the few inches allotted to him had been swallowed up. He was about to abandon the seat altogether to go and lean against the wall when Frida captured about 6 inches from the large lady on her right and offered to him so prettily that he could not refuse. And there he sat very close for the rest of the evening. Mr. E.G. Timpany was called upon to address them. Moist and triumphant, he stepped forward, clutching a large bundle of notes, and looked all gold spectacles and teeth and preposterous auburn curls. He beamed upon them. For such moments as these, he would gladly have sold all Wolverhampton. He produced figures, compared the numbers in Ephraim of those in Dan, was convinced that Gad would soon outstrip Issachar, and gave them percentages. Indeed, he made such good use of his correspondence course in accountancy that Inigo expected him at any moment to remember his other course and drop into commercial Spanish. It was impossible not to like Mr. Timpany. He was so innocently happy, so naively proud of his position as organizing secretary. Inigo found it quite painful to think that just when Mr. Timpany was beginning to enjoy this life, he would either have to quit it or be compelled to admit he was a fool, unless it was possible for the second resurrectionist continually to postpone doomsday. Mrs. Bevison Burr, the commanding woman, came next. Her subject was unbelief. She referred to unbelief as if it were a very obnoxious person who was in the habit of insulting her every morning and evening. Mrs. Bevison Burr commanded them to do all manner of things to unbelief. She did not hold out any great hopes for them when they had done all these things. Only a few of them were wanted by Jehovah, but the least they could do was settle unbelief. They were asked to remember that unbelief and Bolshevism were one and the same. There was a little more about Jehovah, to whom she referred as if he were a prominent politician staying at her country house. Mrs. Bevison Burr was not a success, though her presence there was evidently gratifying to most of her audience. Major Dunker followed. His themes were the pyramids, international relations, and earthquakes. Holding a little notebook very close to his face, he talked at some length of pyramid inches, which determined all the chief dates in the histories of the world, but it was difficult to follow this part of his speech because of his notebook. He passed on to international relations, which were rapidly approaching a supreme crisis. We were on the eve of the greatest and last of all wars, the real Armageddon, but worse was to come, earthquakes. Everybody had noticed that in recent years there had been more and more storms and floods and earthquakes, and scientists had all been baffled by these phenomena. All over the world they were investigating to discover the cause of these disturbances. They could find nothing. The causes were not in the mere rise and fall of the barometer, nor even in spots in the sun. Forces were being let loose on this planet that had formerly been restrained. These were the first activities of the newly released. And when the thousands of years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. And having delivered this quotation in the same dry tones he had used throughout, the Major abruptly concluded. He was, Inigo decided, quietly and decently mad. Mr. Grudy called for the testimony of other friends. Nobody spoke for a minute or two. Then a man with a black beard jumped up, said something about King George V being the 99th in succession from King David, and then sat down again. He was followed by a shrill little woman who declared that she had dreamt 4 times that year of an angel waving something that looked like a golden coal scuttle over the dome of St. Paul's. Mr. Grudy nodded approvingly at her, but there seemed to be a general impression that she had not done well in putting herself forward in this way. After that, there was another wait. Then Mr. Grudy stepped forward again and was about to address them when there was a stir at the back of the hall. "I see that our friend, the Reverend Higginworth Wenderby, has arrived," cried Mr. Grudy. "I am sure he will be pleased to give us his testimony. It's a privilege to have him here with us." A tall, stout man in black climbed onto the platform and stood there, panting and mopping his brow, while they applauded furiously. He was a curious figure. He had a mane of dark hair and an unusually large, white, wet face which retreated at the forehead and the chin. "My dear friends," he boomed, "please allow me a moment. I cannot talk to you without breath, and I have come here in such haste that I have no breath." Everybody applauded again, including Inigo, who looked around and saw that a change had come over the whole meeting. Everybody seemed expectant. They were leaning forward now, all eager attention. Mr. Wenderby held up a large white hand. "My friends," he began softly this time, "it is a joy to address you once more and there are not many joys in this vale of suffering and sorrow. We live here in sin, and death is busy among the people. The husband must go from the wife, and the mother must weep over the departed child. He continued in this strain for some time, his voice as artful and moving as a passage from muted strings. The matter was nothing, the manner everything, and even Indigo, who had disliked the man at sight, found himself vaguely moved. As for the rest of his audience, they frankly abandoned themselves to the luxury of easy emotion. Some of the women sobbed. Frida stirred uneasily in bitter underlip. Indigo sat there in both physical and mental discomfort. Mr. Wenderby paused and let his head droop. Then he raised it higher and higher, until at last his white, wet face seemed to shine in the light. "But have I come here, my friends, to bear testimony to these things?" he asked, without raising his voice. "Are they strange tidings, these of sin and misery and death, that I should come and relate them to you? Have I nothing more to say? Is it the end of the message?" He stepped forward another pace so that he stood on the very edge of the platform. "No," he thundered, "no, and a thousand times no." "Ephraim," yelled a voice in Inigo's ear. "I beg your pardon," he cried, startled, but the man, who had drawn up a chair just behind Inigo, took no notice whatever of him, but stared fixedly at the preacher. "I look for the word, and the word is here, Mr. Wenderby. Now, when full diapes and held up the Bible, and after these things," he chanted, "I heard a great voice of much people in heaven saying, Alleluia, salvation and glory and honor and power unto the Lord our God, for true and righteous are his judgments, for he hath judged the great whore which did corrupt the earth, and hath avenged the blood of his servants at her hand." And again they said, "Alleluia," and her smoke rose up forever and ever. Mr. Wenderby then crumbled the world to dust and blew it away in one mighty shout. He led the faithful to their eternal home. He arrayed them in fine linen and took them through the gates of pearl and along the streets of pure gold to where the river of water of life flowed from the throne of the Lamb. The arms he raised seemed to lift most of the audience out of their seats. If they had groaned before, now they shouted. Only Mrs. Bevison Burr and Major Dunker remained unmoved. Mr. Timpany had taken off his spectacles and was wiping them feverishly. Mr. Grudy towered in his chair, and his face grew bright in the glow of unseen desert suns. Inigo looked round in astonishment. The place was a pandemonium. Face after face, almost transfigured, caught and held his glance. This, then, was the secret. These moments, crashing in Dionysiac rout through months of boredom, glittering and trumpeting for a space in lives as quiet and faded as an old photograph. Something pitiful tugged at his heart, and then was gone. Well, that's the end of their meeting. He does take leave of them after a while, and we never really find out what happens to Mr. Timpany. Since the world did not end, I don't know. Maybe at that time. It was written.
Maybe it did for them.
Maybe it did. But, Priestley and Dickens especially are such excellent reporters of life as it's going on, good observers. And Priestley's still fun to read if you see some of his works. We've got good companions in the bookstore, and of course Don Quixote and Pickwick Papers are in the bookstore. But they're all enjoyable, especially, and they're good for long trips, especially when you're on a bus ride. I don't know what else to do. Because they're fun to read for a short time. And, you could put them down and stop at the bus station. Get off. So,
thank you.